going on, y'all? You're listening to Chain Reaction, and I am your host, Jeremiah Mitchell, joined today by myself. Harding apparently threw out his back hauling stuff for his grandpa over, I don't know, maybe it was over the weekend, but he did so. So he doesn't feel like he can sit for very long, which I don't feel like I can sit for very long either. So I don't know how much of an excuse that is, although for me it's not severe back pain. I just move my hands around a lot and shake and put my leg on the table and shit like that. I should probably be using a standing desk. That would make more sense. So that sucks. You know, when I'm prepping for a show, which I think is obvious, usually there's somewhat of a minimal amount of prep work being done. That's the beauty of having a conversation with someone, is that it can just kind of flow. But usually when I'm prepping, I just come up with a few sort of half-assed ideas that I want to sort through conversation. And then when I'm left alone, like, I don't know, some sort of poor bride at the altar whose groom left her for because of back pain? Does that make sense? When I'm left alone, I have to try to sort through ideas by talking through them, which is not the way I sort through ideas. I do so through conversation or by writing. So trying to talk through this stuff is difficult, but I hope to have some reasonable stuff to bring to you today. I do plan on it being a fairly brief show, but usually I think 10 minutes and then I go 40. I'm really thinking 25 or less is realistic today. We'll see. But one good thing is our Skype connection is going to be fantastic. Don't have to worry about any drop calls or audio quality being poor with that. So, few things. Let's see. It's 95 degrees here in September in Wisconsin. No, you don't care about that. But, you know, global warming is real. Hide your kids. Hide your wife. I went for a jog yesterday and was stung by a bee, and I'm allergic to bees, but guess what? I didn't swell up, so I was pretty fucking stoked about that. One of the things I hate most about being me is that I'm allergic to bees. And today, 9/24/2017, it's the day where hashtag take a knee is trending on Twitter, and a bunch of NFL players are kneeling down in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick or against Donald Trump or because racism or I don't know, that's just the way the cultural winds are shifting right now, which is fine. I prefer, you know, if you've been listening to this podcast at all, you know, I have a particular hatred in my heart for the flag and for state worship because it's one of the most evil gods you can worship. And I think it's really a sick practice to have in our culture. But the thing that bothers me about the take a knee thing most is that it's still people treating the ritual with great seriousness and giving it great dignity by kneeling before it. I think the proper way to protest the national anthem is to sit on the bench and play Angry Birds on your phone. That might be a little outdated phone gaming reference. Or to go through your playbook with your coach and talk to him and just ignore what's going on at all. But kneeling before it and looking before it is still just basically pleading with your God to do things differently during the worship service. It's like, oh, please, state, don't have your cops be racist. You need to put more white people in jail so our percentages are even. That is seems to be kind of the way that these people think about justice. As long as the racial percentages are in line with the population percentages, it's all good. So you just start stopping more and arresting more white people and Asians, bring those numbers up to the blacks and Hispanics, and there you go. Magic, you have justice. So I think it's a rather shallow cause that they're working toward. The real problem is policing in America. Not racism, although I'm sure that plays a part in some areas having to do with policing. I don't know. I'm guessing it does. Doesn't address the real issue, and they're still giving this dumbass, fucked up ceremony a ton of honor that it does not deserve, which didn't exist in the NFL until like a decade ago because the Department of Defense started paying teams millions of dollars to have the national anthem before the game and to have these military-type ceremonies, some of which are quite over the top. All right, that's not the main thing I wanted to talk about today. Where am I at for time? I'm only 5 minutes in, dudes. This is fantastic. We're going to be out of here in 20 minutes. Maybe I'm showing my hand a little bit too much that I'm not super interested in podcasting alone, but I have no problem telling you that. So I was having a conversation Wednesday. It was actually at a Bible study. We got to talking about immigration, and I got to talking about how taxation is murder back theft and why the welfare state complicates things and bringing in refugees complicates things and why the state borders are inherently illegitimate when, you know, when all this is tied to the state being completely illegitimate, you know. And I got a lot of, it wasn't in a room of a bunch of Christian anarchists. It's just normal status, fairly normal. There's some weird ass guys in there, but what struck me by the responses, I was going to say counter arguments. I don't know that I would necessarily call them that, but they were responses in terms of presenting arguments for the justifications of the state. And here's something I've noticed in the past and something I'm sure other people have talked about, but I don't believe we've ever talked about at the show. And I don't know the last time I heard this from other people or if I even have, but one thing that struck me is that most of these statist arguments rely on the use of voluntarist principles in order to try to communicate them. Meaning, what people try to do is frame things in such a way so that it sounds like the state is a voluntary institution based upon property rights and I wasn't going to say consumer choice, but based upon, you know, the ability of individuals to choose. The arguments they make, many, at least most of the time, are based on ideas of consent. And what, this is so fascinating because it tells you what's in the heart of man a little bit. It tells you that in the conscience of individuals is already built in this idea that only voluntary relationships are justified, that only consensual relationships are what is right. Let me give you a few examples. Some of them will be from the conversation. Some won't be. I'll tell you which ones. Not that anyone that was in that conversation will be listening to this podcast, I don't believe. But one guy said, did sort of a variation, because I was, you know, just discussing why the state has, as a group of individuals, has no right to use violence to control other individuals. And he said, well, if I invite you into my home, you know, I would expect that you'll take your shoes off, that you'll be respectful, that you won't swear around my kids. And also, if I ever invite you into my home, feel free to swear around my kids. I just don't tell my wife you're doing it. That will upset her. So the argument he made is somewhat of a variation of the, if you don't like it, you can leave type of argument. It's this idea that if he invites me into his home, there are certain expectations that go along with that. And of course, I'm an anarchist. I would honor those expectations. He has every right to decide what to do with his own property. But the implication of his argument is that the state and governments are very much like an individual's home. And if you want to exist within their borders, then you have to obey their will. You have to respect their wishes on their property. Now, it's, of course, the state as an organization that exists through plunder has no sort of property rights. That you can't, if you're a thief, if you steal $1,000 from someone, and with that $1,000 you buy a bike, that bike still doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the person from whom you have stolen. And it's the same with the state, who use tax money to claim land. And actually, a lot of land that they claim, they don't even homestead. They just say, this is ours. They don't even build a building on it. They just make a declaration, and without mixing labor, even without mixing taxpayer-funded labor, call it their own. So the state doesn't have property rights per se. But it tells you what's going on in people's brains when they're doing this, is they're trying to use property rights to justify the state, even though they're not the same thing, which means that property rights are very important to them, and that they see property rights as the ethical way to determine what happens with a particular piece of land or an item, or how people, that the owner of the property rightfully gets to decide how people can behave in that property. And then there's also, I was going to say one more note on the property rights thing. Oh, it's just so obvious. Not only does state not have property rights, but the state is the person that, or is a group of people that will go into his house and not have him tell them how to behave, but they will tell him, they'll go onto his property and say, this is what you must do with your property and with your kids and with your family, as opposed to what he was originally describing as, he says he has the right over his property and the state is the one who violates it. And then democracy, there's a couple of ways where democracy plays into this voluntary sort of consent thing. One, it gives the illusion of consumer choice, and then people can talk about it. Well, you get a choice between Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or, you know, Gary Johnson. But obviously this choice is fake, but they're able to frame that as if it's something similar to a market choice, as if it's the same thing as saying you have a choice between McDonald's or Burger King. I mean, this is obviously a lie, because you not only have a choice between McDonald's and Burger King, you also have a choice to pick no one. Whereas if you pick no one with the state, some person will be appointed for you otherwise. If you choose Burger King and more people choose McDonald's, you will not have McDonald's forced down your throat. But if you choose Ron Paul and everyone else picks Barack Obama, Barack Obama is forced down your throat. I should have thought about that a little more carefully before I said it that way, but you get the point. And additionally, with democracy, they frame it as a we, as if because you have a say in who runs the government, a small, statistically insignificant say that they don't really give a fuck about, to choose a few people who are more than likely bought off by a bunch of wealthy corporations who control things anyway, so it's not like what you say is going to make a significant difference, but the idea that you get a choice, that you get to participate in the process of choosing someone, means that it's a we, or they frame it that it's a we. We are the ones who pick the government, therefore we are the rulers, therefore we are the government. As one who has an option to influence the government, I therefore am a part of it, according to this way of thinking. And people, they want to frame democracies as if the individual suddenly becomes the collective, as if what the government does, the individual is responsible for. And this is so obviously bullshit. I think Murray Rothbard puts it best. I'm paraphrasing. I'm not sure exactly what he said, but he said, if we are the government in a democracy, then the Holocaust was merely a mass Jewish suicide. Because if they're the government, then they did that to themselves. That is where that sort of reasoning leads to. But again, it tells you what's in people's hearts and what's in people's consciences. They think that individual choice is important. They think that alternative options are important for ethics. And they think that people should have the ability to decide what happens to them and how they run their own lives. And thus, they use democracy as an argument, which it's obviously flawed. But the foundation behind it are these voluntarist principles of consent and choice and respect for individual humans. And I think when you think about that, you can probably think of a lot of different examples, but they also talk about just fees for service, that if you're paying, that you already receive services from the government, and therefore you should have to pay for those services, just like in a market where you pay for services that you desire. The problem is state services are forced upon you. They're really fucking shitty and oftentimes evil, and they usually only are able to have those services because they have a monopoly on those services. There's all sorts of complicating factors. But again, the underlying principle, because you asked for service A, you have to pay for it. That is a part of the contract that you are engaging in, which tells you that contracts are important to people, and paying for the stuff that you want is something that is important to people, that they believe is ethical. It's just more of these market ways of arguing for the state that you find in these conversations, which I think is, I haven't thought through the best way to communicate this with others, but I believe that is helpful to point out what is actually going on behind their arguments in addition to refuting them. That behind their arguments, they know what is right. They feel what is right. They sense that voluntarism is the right way to think about human ethics, and thus they use voluntarist principles to justify the state. One more thing. It's really based upon the Declaration of Independence, this idea, I think. The idea that government derives its power from the consent of the governed. You hear, this came up in the conversation, but yeah, my throat's a little raw from chatting too much. Also, I've had a lot of coffee, so that's why I'm talking really fast sometimes. It's obviously false. I mean, we all know the government does not derive its power from the consent of the governed. Like, it might be the consent of some of the governed, but the only real way to know whether or not they're consenting is if you put them in a situation where, I can't think of the opposite of consent, where the option to not consent is available. So you can't really tell if someone is, someone holds a gun, someone's head and says, have sex with me or I'll shoot you. You cannot tell if that relationship is consensual unless the threat is removed. Even if the person with the gun to their head says, yeah, I totally consent to this behavior, you can't make any sort of evaluation about whether or not he or she truly consents unless it is obvious that the initiation of force, that the coercion has been removed from the situation. And thus, you can't tell even if the people who say they consent actually consent to state interaction. And I think most people listening to this podcast know that that's just an example. The people that say they consent and love their government, that's mostly an example of Stockholm Syndrome. That's the kind of, thank you, Sam Warner, dissent. That's like an abusive relationship with a child. I don't know if I've made a point on this podcast before, but I have on others, that the state interacts with the citizens like an abusive parent does or an abusive spouse does, except they're weaker than children relative to abuse. Individuals relative to the state are weaker than children relative to abusive parents and are weaker than spouses relative to abusive husbands or wives. What they do is they beat you with one hand and they feed you with another, and they create this really emotionally confusing situation where they do provide all these different things for you. You know, I'm certainly glad that I have roads, even if they're not as good as they would be in a free market. I use government services in some way all the time because they're the only option. So, you know, it's a good thing that the abusive parent feeds their children, but it's a pretty bad thing that they also punch them in the face, and it creates a sense of emotional confusion for the child. I don't know how many of you have suffered this or have been in close relationships with others who have, but it's real difficult for the kid, even as they grow up, to get clarity on this and to know how they should feel about this, because their parent obviously did so many good things for them and did so many evil things to them. And it's much the same way with the state. I think you have a bunch of people who act like abused children, like people who, you know, were kidnapped and fell in love with their kidnapper, or came to see their kidnapper as their caretaker and parent. They are emotionally, they don't really know what to do. I mean, the way that they argue for the state when faced with morally consistent people like anarchists makes them seem like they absolutely adore their parents, and yet they will severely criticize the actions of the government around most other people, at least when you talk to a bunch of minarchists like I do. So, again, emotionally confused children, people suffering from Stockholm Syndrome, still under the threat of coercion, you certainly can't tell, no, regardless of what they say, whether or not this relationship is consensual. They're obviously confused individuals. But, again, the notion that the government derives its powers from the consent of the governed is a completely voluntarist principle. Read Bastiat, who, you know, is a minarchist still, but Molinari, who Bastiat said knew his work better than he did. Molinari said that the implications of his work were that he was an anarchist. At least that would be Bastiat being logically consistent. But he talks about, you know, the law is the right to collectivize, to defend property rights. And he says that the only government should only be able to do what an individual has the right to do. All government rights come from individual rights, and the state has no right to do to others what the individual does not, which is perfectly consistent with anarchy. Like, in any company I hire doesn't have the right to do things that I don't do in order to protect my property or to protect others. It's fascinating how ingrained in us. Maybe it's because of culture. I think it's probably a combination of culture and biology. Voluntarism is, that consent is, that peaceful human interaction is, that property rights are. And we find that even while people are arguing for something that is completely different than the market, that is completely separate, that is oppositional to voluntary relationships, that's oppositional to what the claims they seem to want to uphold, they have to do so in order to make their arguments seem reasonable or ethical in any sense. They have to use our principles to try to argue for their violation of our principles. That makes sense. And I think if I wrote about this, I might be able to twist their argument or frame it in a way that brings a little more clarity. But like I said, I'm just sort of wrote some stuff down earlier on this afternoon, and then I changed the baby's diaper and gave him some food. So I think that's all I have for you today. It's getting really fucking hot in this room, and I could probably, you know, wander off into North Korea territory like I am prone to do, talking about foreign policy bullshit, but I'm not going to do that. Foreign policy is stupid. U.S. foreign policy are a bunch of fucking murderers. Oh, one last thing. My Twitter feed, there's so many people in my Twitter feed talking about how upsetting it was and how dishonorable it was to the office of the presidency that Trump said, called Colin Kaepernick, I believe, or maybe called people generally. I think it was Colin Kaepernick. Might have been NFL players generally. He called him a son of a bitch. Oh, the nerve. The nerve of some president to use the term son of a bitch to describe another individual. I mean, this is the stuff that they want to get morally outraged over. What the fuck are you doing? What the fuck? What are we even talking about? He said a naughty word? Now, I'm extraordinarily bothered that I'm at least mildly perturbed. That's more realistic. A description. I'm mildly perturbed that the president is criticizing people for disrespecting the flag, because the flag doesn't deserve any sort of respect at all. But he's murdering people. He's murdering people overseas, and people are concerned that he isn't acting presidential enough. That is the biggest criticism of Trump amongst some of the people I follow on Twitter. He's just not quite professional. You know, he's not dignified. They don't say politically correct, but he's not politically correct. He doesn't talk about people properly. You know, He's killing people. He wants to do increase trade sanctions and do trade protectionism. These things are horribly destructive and evil. His new healthcare plan is complete bullshit, and every single one is complete bullshit. And you want to talk to me about him saying the word bitch? What the fuck are we even talking about? What is this? This world has come to, like, it's not only not seeing the forest for the trees, it's, or whatever that saying is, but it's like looking at a nuclear explosion. No, I can't think of what I want to say, you guys. I'm going to get there. It's like seeing an attacking army coming for your home and your family and your friends, and then being really focused about your minor ant infestation in your house, and everyone focusing on that as if that's the most important thing. There's just zero prioritization or perspective. And what the left really wants is someone who is tolerant and well-spoken, like Barack Obama, who panders to people's desires and who really is a good. He's very skilled at giving speeches, and he does have skilled speechwriters, and he has really good comedic timing. He's fun, you know. What was the old saying? Oh, he's like a president that you'd want to have a beer with. That's their concern about the presidency. And that's probably what they'll remember most about Obama's legacy. He was the respectable president, you know, a black president, no less, who was articulate, speaking like white people. But I'll always remember Barack Obama as the Nobel Peace Prize winner who was responsible for the bombing of a Doctors Without Borders hospital, I believe in Libya, and killed another Nobel Peace Prize winner. I mean, when will we ever see that again? We've never seen that before, and we've never seen that again. I bet there will be never be another time in history when a Nobel Peace Prize winner murders another Nobel Peace Prize winner. That's Obama's legacy, but they don't want to hear about that. They want to talk about how much someone condemns racism, or whether or not they use a naughty word. But that's what anarchists are here for, right, y'all? We're here to bring the focus back to the things that actually matter. All right. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate you listening and watching. Sam, I'll check the chat and see if there's anything there to respond to in a minute. Hope you all have a great week. Peace.